Hello and welcome Behind the Marquee, the podcast coming to you from the Michigan Theater, where we talk about movies and everything that's going on in our art house community. My name is Nick Alderink, and I'm the cinema programming manager of this 94-year-old Ann Arbor institution. And today you are going to hear my conversation with Roger Rappaport, author and playwright, as well as the writer and producer of Coming Up for Air, which we will be playing on Friday, September 30th at 7:30 in the main auditorium with Roger in attendance, along with his co-writer and star of the film, Deborah Staples, lead actor Chase Yee, and their cinematographer, Bruce Shermer. This is a locally made film shot primarily in West Michigan with some scenes in Ann Arbor, which you will hear us talk about. About a single mom and her journey to help her son deal with the mental stresses so many young people deal with today as they try to juggle multiple practices. In this case, Chase plays Stan, a high diver with promising athletic prospects who is struggling to keep his head above water as his academics and personal life begin to waver. And so a key part of this conversation deals with how Roger and the crew took on the challenge of capturing the stunts in the film, as well as the heavy emotions and sensitive subject matter. And so at our event, because of these themes, we'll also be joined by mental health professionals that can expound on and shine a brighter light on the subject. But I'll have more details about the event at the end of the episode. But I will say this screening is a part of our Cinetopia Presents series, keeping the spirit of our former film festival alive with community events such as this that will include a pre-film reception as well as the post-film discussion. So we're really looking forward to this one. I hope you all can make it. Until then, enjoy this conversation I had with Roger Rappaport. Hey, Roger. Thank you so much for giving me your time to talk about your film.
Thanks, Nick. I'm glad to be with you.
So first I want to ask, where are you based?
So I live in Muskegon. For those of you who haven't had an opportunity to visit Muskegon, it's on Lake Michigan, and it's 3 hours from Ann Arbor.
Yes, and that is where I am from originally. Yeah, and that's right. Where I am from originally. So I was right. Very familiar with the settings and in the film. And so the Coming Up for Air, which is what we're here to talk about, did you work with primarily with a crew from the area?
Yes, almost the entire crew, including the Ann Arbor crew that we recruited for those scenes, came from Michigan. And almost all of the actors are from Michigan and Wisconsin. In Chicago.
Gotcha. Oh yeah. I love seeing local filmmakers like that. So I just wanted to local projects, and you shooting in Michigan was just you don't see that. That doesn't happen that much. So, it was really great to see you utilize those locations so well. Was shooting in West Michigan, was that a pragmatic, approach, or was there an intention to highlight the scenery of the area?
Well, we wanted to have a Midwestern community, and we did. And we called it Grand Haven, although we used many different cities, including Muskegon, you know, Ludington, Grand Rapids, Holland, and of course Ann Arbor. But we blended them all into a town we called Grand Haven, and we did use the real Grand Haven for part of it. But what's important, I think, to understand is that. When Governor Snyder killed the tax incentives, all the movies that were being made in Michigan with Hollywood money or out-of-state money, that market dried up. But as you know, there's a huge acting base in the Midwest, especially in Michigan, in the Milwaukee area and Chicago. I say Michigan because there's, you know, we draw from all over the state. But we also draw a little bit from Wisconsin. Our lead actress, Deborah Staples, is from Milwaukee. Chase Yee, who plays her son, is from Portage, now lives in LA. So he was the sole LA, you know, cast member in the film, but he's a native. So basically everybody working on the film, all the way up to and including our, post-production director, we're all from the Midwest.
Oh, that's really great to hear. So as a writer, you and Deborah co-wrote the film. Where did the story begin for you?
Well, it's been about 8 years ago now. There was an event in Santa Barbara where a family called the police saying that their son had left Los Angeles heading home to threatening to hurt somebody. And the police went and interviewed him and decided he was fine. And then he went out and there was some tragic shooting. And as a result of that law event, the state of California passed basically a red flag law that says you can detain anybody for 72 hours. So that case, along with a number of others, formed the basis for the story. Many people ask, is it based on one story? No, it's based on many different stories. So it is a fictional story, but it's based on a lot of true stories that we research.
Yeah. And so how did you connect with Deborah Staples? Did you bring the story to her and you began on?
Well, Deborah had been in the first two films, and she's a actress who has done about 125 stage plays. And she frequently does, if your audience is familiar, The Blonde, The Brunette, and The Vengeful Redhead, where she plays seven characters, including, you know.
Oh, wow.
She's on plays where she's on Hamlet. So obviously she's played male roles. She's played children, men and women. So when I wrote the script, I thought, you know, she could read from the point of view of each actor and then comment that way. Did it ring true? And she gave me a lot of notes that made it clear to me that she would be the perfect collaborator, even though she'd never written or published anything. And as an actress, you know, she was able, I think, to bring, reality check to the script.
Yeah.
What I mean by that is we worked very closely with an editor in Los Angeles named Gene Gamache, who also does our trailers. And we had Gene in on the script from day one, which is not the norm, but he and Deborah together, along with Bob Cicchini, of course, who was the director, basically shaped the story so that when Bob was actually directing the actors, we had what I call actor speak, as opposed to a script that looks okay on the page but doesn't play well on the screen. So that was one of our challenges.
Yeah, I was gonna add, because you as a writing team, you as a writer and producer, and she as a writer and a performer. I guess you kind of answered it, but could you go into more about the back and forths as the writing process? You said that she brought the reality check to you. I'm sure that you were thinking of the film from the production side and what's feasible. Was there a lot of back and forth of you kind of checking
each
other?
Well, we had one thing going for us. We both have children.
Yeah.
And we both have health issues. And I say that broadly in the sense that we understood what it's like to be a caregiver parent when a kid is having trouble. But the issue in this movie that confronted us both, even though I've had college age children and she just after the movie was done, her eldest finally to college, but I had some direct experience with the situation where you are no longer in loco parentis, you know, you're not there with your kid to supervise or keep an eye on them. And that's the story. Her son is basically telling her everything's perfect when he's away at school, and she's picking up signals, even though she's not with him, that something's wrong. So we did have that going for us in that as parents, we were able to bring that point of view. And the story is about the mom's journey trying to help adult challenges, the caregiver side of the story, which is rarely dealt with, almost parenthetically dealt with in mental health drama. It's usually almost always about the person who's having the challenges.
Right.
So that was both an opportunity, but it also presented a very big problem for us, which is that we had to basically do the hardest thing possible in screenwriting, which is, as you know, in Hollywood, they often lock the writers off the set. And that's because they don't want their deathless prose to be tampered with. So if something has to be rewritten, often it's not the original screenwriter because they don't want to change what they knocked themselves out to do.
Yeah.
And they'll bring in another writer. And this is not a joke. It actually does happen. In this mm-hmm. case, we had a double conflict of interest. It's very rare for a director and a producer to give any control of a script to a lead actor. It doesn't happen, you know, mm-hmm. unless you're, you know, an incredible, iconic celebrity. And even there, there's, you know, a lot of give and take. So giving Deborah a voice and her character was unusual. And then as a producer, it's not unusual for a producer to be a screenwriter, but I would say there's another conflict of interest there, because obviously the producer has a lot of other things coming at him besides writing a screenplay. So that put both of us kind of in jeopardy, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the director, Robert Cicchini.
He's probably best known for being in Godfather 3, but he's been in Six Feet Under. Most recently, he just shot a film, the George Foreman biopic. He plays Angelo Dundee, the manager. He's a light sleeper. He's been in, many major feature films. The Morning Show with Jennifer Aniston. So, Bob's, if you turn on late night TV, chances are you'll probably catch something he's in.
Yeah,
and he's from Detroit.
Gotcha. I saw that in his IMDb. I was astounded by his acting credits. And he made his feature debut just 10 years ago with your film Waterwalk.
As a director.
So where does your story begin with him?
So Bruce Schirmer, who was our cinematographer, shot most of Michael Moore's first movie, Roger and Me. And I interviewed Bruce for a book I did on Michael Moore. That book, Citizen Moore, from that relationship, I published a book called Waterwalk, and I wanted to film it. And Bruce put me in touch with Bob, who directed and co-starred in that movie with Che Shi, who's a star with Deborah in the new movie. So Bob has directed two of my films and played a key role in the third, which is called Pilot Error.
Yeah, and so you must have a trust with him, because I was wondering. With you and Deborah working so closely as writers, and then you bring a third person into the mix to piece it all together. What did Robert find in the story that maybe that you and Deborah hadn't intended or hadn't really discovered for yourselves?
Well, actually, he was the decider on the script. We didn't greenlight the project until Bob finally decided that he thought it worked. He's a very tough critic. I think what Bob brought was something that's really, I think he's, from my mind, he's the most underrepresented actor in Hollywood. He's a phenomenal actor, and he's a phenomenal acting teacher. And a lot of the actors in our movie are well-known stage actors who your Michigan theater audience will recognize from performances they've done great. But many of them have had little or no stage experience, and Bob teaches stage to film. So that's one of the things that he's able to take somebody who's a very good on stage and get them to relax, basically. And Bob's key thing is that he knows how to work with great stage actors and make them comfortable in front of a camera.
Oh, okay. So was high diving or was diving always at the center of the film? How did you land on diving as a?
I had had another project that didn't work out about a high diver. Who actually, her name was Mickey King. And Mickey, this was when there was no women's diving or swimming team at Michigan. And she went on to the Olympics and won the gold without being part of a college team. And that story didn't work out. But I was fascinated by high diving. And I did some research. And there are no high diving movies. And I can tell you right now, Nick, having done one, there probably will never be another high diving for a lot of issues related to insurance and safety. But we were able to do that primarily because of the diving team at Michigan. And we were very fortunate to work with the coaches there who gave us use of the pool. So the major scenes in this film, all the diving scenes were shot, almost all of them, were shot in Ann Arbor at the Natatorium. And Dick Kimball, who's the legendary diving coach who retired, was one of our advisors for the film.
Okay. Can you talk about the difficulties of shooting the diving scenes?
Well, we had four different cameras working those scenes. And we had to do quite a wide variety of shots. And we had very limited time to do it. We only had 2 days to do all that shooting. But the good is that thanks to the background actors who were the dive teams, it was a very well organized shoot. And Bob works very well under pressure, and he is Chase is an athlete. And so we were able to get a lot done. It was almost a miracle that we were able to finish those scenes in 2 days. But you'll never see another movie that has all those dives, somebody diving off a 35-foot high platform.
Yeah.
And that I think is one of the things about the film that, you know, is unique and has helped it a lot. We've won, Deborah and Chase have both won a number of Best Actor awards. And I really think that the angle was very important to the success of the film. But I also think the diving gave it kind of a unique flavor. It was really kind of unduplicated, you know, in terms of its uniqueness. You know, there are many sports films, but nobody makes high diving films.
Yeah, when did you learn in the writing process? I'm sure it's easy to write down the character dives or to describe those on the paper. Where in the process did you start to foresee that this might be an issue? And was there any hesitation to step back away from it when you started to learn that maybe this isn't going to be as easy as you thought it was going to be?
Not for a second. We had full control of everything at that pool. It was highly orchestrated. Every camera, you know, it wasn't as if we went in there blind. We knew what shots we needed.
Yeah.
We had a shot list and so on. I mean, I'm not saying everything went perfectly, far from it. There were always moments when we were trying to, we had two units, so we were shooting, you know, in the training room and things like that, coaching scenes, and then background diving scenes. So there were different things going on. We had a high-speed camera. We had a regular camera. We had an underwater camera, et cetera, et cetera. But basically working from that shot list, we were able to get coverage of everything that we needed so that when it came time to edit, we had, you know, full coverage of every dive we needed, you know?
Yeah. All those shots look fantastic and you did a really great job, showcasing it, especially Chase. Is he an experienced diver?
No. And the answer to that question is, the stunt diver that we used in the movie, who is a real diver and is actually a stuntman, but he doesn't get much diving work because nobody wants to do diving movies.
Yeah.
So he was thrilled to have an opportunity to do what he's really good at. But when he saw the movie, he thought he'd been cut from it. He didn't realize he's about the same body type as Chase. And so many people thought Chase had done all his dives.
Yeah.
He did some of the lower ones, but not any of the high dives. That would have been impossible. So we were quite surprised when the diver told us that he thought he'd been cut from the movie, when in fact we just, we did wig him, you know, so that he would look a little bit more like Chase. At one point, his wig fell off. But a lot of people assume Chase did every dive.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the editing is fantastic then, because I definitely would. I didn't know that.
Well,
I didn't know the difference.
Well, we do all of our posts in Los Angeles. We do all the shooting in Michigan, but we do all our posts in LA. We had an amazing editing team, studio level people working for us. They love to moonlight on these movies.
Yeah.
You know, it's fun for them.
Yeah. I keep asking these questions for, I did with Deborah and with Bob. And I want to talk about Chase. He handles the complexity of those emotions so well, and just the maelstrom of so I'm wondering if what he brought to the role that maybe you specifically hadn't identified yourself, and how did the character change with Chase? Did you write with him in mind?
Actually, I didn't. We had hired another actor, but it didn't work out, and Chase came in and took over the role just a few weeks before we started. You know, I wasn't sure he was available, and you know, we were concerned about the geography issue because he's now living in LA. But he works very closely with Bob. They shot Water Walk together as father and son. So here he is playing now, you know, the son of Deborah. And he and Bob communicate very, very well. They've worked on other projects together. They become very close personal friends in Los Angeles. Very proud of Chase. He went to UCLA and won the Poetry Award. He's just a great actor, and he works seamlessly with Bob. They really communicate well.
Okay. Did you have mental health advisors active in influencing the script?
Yes, before, during, and after. When I say after, we had a mental health issue in my own family, and a lot of the things that are in the movie I personally encountered as a parent while we were editing the film. Before we shot, we did a lot of interviewing of, you know, professionals and then showed them the script. The same was true with the police side of the story. So we did a lot of fact checking. But the key thing that I want to say about the mental health side of the story is that, you know, as you'll see in the Michigan Theater event we're going to do, whenever we show this movie, we always do a Q&A because people come to the film often for the first time to deal with questions they've got about mental health. And we always have mental health experts there. And that's what's happening at the Michigan Theater. And that is our pattern. We never pretend to try to answer any of those kinds of questions, particularly when they get into heavy issues like, well, how do I know whether or not potentially this person might be a suicide risk? You know, that's completely beyond our, you know, we would never go there. Yeah. So fortunately, we've been able to do many, many events like the one in Ann Arbor, where we have local experts.
Okay. And these Q&As that you've had at other screenings, what have been the takeaways that you've seen most people getting from the film? What's been the reaction that you've widely received?
Well, basically, what most people tell us is that they find that the film, and these are the professionals, because we do suicide prevention conferences and so forth, that basically what the film does is it puts a face on the problem. So you're not just looking at a PowerPoint or a bunch of statistics or a lot of, you know, psychiatric terminology. Basically the film shows what it's like to be a caregiver, how you like it or not, you may involuntarily have to become one. And that essentially in the moment, we're all first responders. So they like that because it opens up people's resistance to getting help. And that's really the point of our movie. So we did the movie Environwood, Michigan, a town of 5,000. We had 450 high school kids there, and we had mental health experts, coaches, the sheriff, all talking about their own mental health challenges. And one of the kids asked the sheriff, how do you deal with post-traumatic stress syndrome? And the sheriff gave a beautiful answer, but the net result was the kids felt that if the sheriff can tell them about his mental health challenges, they can talk to their parents and their friends about it and not feel ashamed. And getting past that stigma is a milestone for a younger person. So that's been one of the most positive impacts. One of the things we're going to be doing in Ann Arbor at the Michigan Theater is we're going to be handing out a document from Rogers Behavioral Health, which is a one-page document that says what to say, what not to say when somebody's talking to you about mental health challenges. And that's been very well received. And people like sharing the film because they feel like it's non-judgmental. It's not making fun of anybody or making anybody look stupid. And the suicide angle, which of course is paramount in the minds of everybody, is something that I think in a theater audience, having a suicide prevention team with brochures and flyers that you can walk out and pick up, and you never know, you might know somebody that could benefit from that, you know, because unfortunately, a lot of these situations come out of nowhere. In this case, Deborah, playing Anna Russell, at least she's getting signals that something's wrong. But what do you do when there's no signals? And that's one of the questions that we get asked. If there are no warning signs, how do you deal with that one? And that's part of what the discussion leads to.
Yeah. So did you and Deborah come out of this project with a new outlook or perspective that you weren't expecting or that you didn't intend to find?
Well, it's hard. I can't speak for both of us, but I could answer the question this way. We were completely surprised by how the audience reacted to the film. And I mean that in terms of we had no idea what to expect. But both of us, I think, have really been touched by the fact that so many people have reached out to us and said, yes, that is a situation that I was in personally. I've lived through it. I had the same thing happen in my family. And that really caught us off guard because we kind of thought we were writing a script about one situation. But when people tell us that many of I had a police chief come up to me after we played the movie in Fremont, Michigan, and he said, how did you possibly get all the police stuff right? I don't understand it. And I said, well, our script advisor was the sheriff in our county. He read the script and, you know, took out all the mistakes. So that kind of reality check, the relatability of the film, particularly in light of what COVID has done, really caught us off guard. The other thing I would say, you know, speaking for both of us, the audiences have been remarkably focused on what the film is trying to do. And I think that speaks a lot to what the Michigan Theater and the cinema community in general is, you know, that you can do things in a film you can't accomplish anywhere else, even on stage.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's terrific. Before we start to wrap up the conversation here, you mentioned COVID and you released this film in 2019. I saw it played at a few festivals in 2019 before the pandemic hit. Can you talk about the journey that this film has taken since you released it? How did you continue to get the word out even as the world was shutting down?
Well, when COVID hit, we had 14 events all over the country that were booked, including a big one in Pasadena. It was going to be like a family reunion for a lot of people that, you know, COVID killed. So we went the festival route, obviously online and so forth, did some streaming and so forth. But in the past 6 months, everything has turned around completely. We've been showing the film pretty much nonstop, meaning the 2 years out, more or less, you know, with a few exceptions that were very, very carefully done, gave us more time to kind of get organized. And we just did a convention with 1,500 law enforcement officers. So it's given us time to kind of build knowledge of the film. And the other thing is that, as you know, the cinemas have changed a lot.
Yeah.
It's created, particularly theaters like the Michigan Theater, are really looking for films that they can turn into community events. And that's been pretty much nonstop for us since COVID began to wane. And I think audiences are starting to come back, but they're expecting more. I think in some sense, the streaming thing was positive in one respect, which is people decided that they really wanted to go with their friends and talk about the movie or have talkbacks. In our case, there's going to be food before the event. That's really helpful because it turns it into a community gathering. And I think that's really what cinema offers.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are burned out on streaming for many different reasons. Obviously, the projection and the sound are better in your theater than they are in your living room.
Yeah.
No question. But above and beyond that, I think the curation of the films that make it into your theater is something that really draws audience because people know you're picking, you know, films that you feel your audiences really want to see, as opposed to something that a large streaming service just decides, you know, that they can throw out there.
Yeah, we're very excited to host this screening, and I can't wait to meet. It's Deborah and Chase and Robert are all attending, right? Yeah.
Bob is not able to make it because he's directing play, but Bruce Shermer, who shot the film, he was our cinematographer.
Oh, terrific!
So Bruce is joining. Bruce
can't wait.
Is kind of a legend.
Okay. You know. I'll say I've. The underwater shots and all the diving scenes specifically, I was just amazed by. So I can't wait to pick his brain about those. So what's next for you? Do you have anything else that you'd like to plug? How can people find you and your films?
Sure. So RogerRappaport.com is my website, and I have a play called Old Heart that premiered in Detroit. In May, and it's now going to begin traveling in Michigan and elsewhere.
Oh, great.
It's a story set in Detroit and the Netherlands during World War II, and then 60 years later. That play, you know, will be up again in the spring in West Michigan, in your neighborhood, actually, your old neighborhood, and elsewhere around the state. So that's the latest. And then I have a book that's coming out next year in advance of the 50th anniversary of the Patty Hearst case, and which I covered, the kidnapping of the media heiress, Patty Hearst, and who ended up becoming a bank robber. And was convicted on bank robbery charges after being a kidnap victim. And whether or not she was a victim of the Stockholm syndrome is basically what the book is about. And it's a fictional book called My Search for Sarah Price that'll be out next year.
Okay. And before we start the conversation, you mentioned something else you'd like to share. Would you like to plug?
Sure. So I was editor of the Michigan Daily. And in 1965, I covered a film called Flaming Creatures, which was considered pornographic by the Ann Arbor police. And a police lieutenant named Eugene Stoudemire came into the State Theater. It was a Cinema Guild event, and seized the film from the projection and stopped the film. And I'm going to give you a link to that Michigan Daily story, an interview I did with Lieutenant Stoudemire about why he felt the film should be seized. And okay. Not shown in it. It's a funny story.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can't wait to read that myself. Yeah, for the listeners, that will be in the show notes or the description of this episode. So be sure to click that.
Great.
Thank you so much, Roger, for giving me your time. I can't wait to meet you at our event at the end of the month.
Thank you very much. Take care.
All right. Thank you again to Roger for joining me for the discussion. At the top of the episode, I forgot to mention the audio issues we had. Roger was in a hotel room, I believe, without ideal Wi-Fi connection, but I tried to cut out the blips as much as I could. Forgive me. I hope it wasn't too intrusive. But again, Roger, Deborah, Chase, and Bruce will be joining us for a screening of Coming Up for Air on Friday, September 30th at 7:30 in the main auditorium, along with Julia Kyle, Director of Behavioral Health Strategy and Planning for Blue Cross Blue Shield, Rachel Amity, a licensed master social worker, athletic counselor, and assistant director of Athletes Connected, and Dr. Victor Hong of Psychiatric Emergency Services at University of Michigan Health. One more time, this is part of our Cinetopia Presents series, which will include two more screenings by the end of the year, For the Left Hand on Friday, October 14th, and Ticket to Paradise on Thursday, October 20th. I'm sure I'll be back in your podcast feeds to talk more about these screenings at a later date. Until then, be sure to follow the Michigan State Theater on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, at Michigan Theater and at State Theater A2. State Theater is spelled theater with an R-E. To stay up to date, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and give us a rating so that we may catch more listeners. Thank you to Matt Gauntlet and the Ann Arbor District Library for making sure these episodes drop on a timely basis. To email the show with topic suggestions or to send us Movie Magic Moments comments, or even let us know if you want to be on the show, you can reach us at btmpod@gmail.com. The theme that you're listening to right now is Keith Manfield's Morning Broadway, a classic library catalog recording. Thank you for listening and joining us behind the marquee.